Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Ruby Rogues Podcast. This week on our panel, we have Dave Kimura.
Hey, everyone.
John Epperson.
Hello.
Luke Stutters.
Hi.
And Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv. Just a quick shout out. Go check out the MVP or most valuable programmer stuff that I'm putting together. It's devchat.tv/MVP. This week, we have a special guest, and that is Eric Hayes. Eric, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Eric. I've been a programmer in some fashion for, I don't know, maybe 20 years, but started working with Ruby and Rails probably around 2007. And yeah, I worked for a school district for 10 years where I did all kinds of things, but one of which was build apps for teachers. And then I did a stint at Red Hat for about a year. And now I work for a small company. I'm the CTO of a small company that builds donor analytics for nonprofit orgs like churches.
Oh, nice. Leveling up is important. I spend at least an hour every day learning ways I can improve my business or take a break and listen to a good book. If you're looking to level up, I recommend you start out with the 12-week year as a system to plan out where you want to end up and how to get the results you want. You can get it free by going to audibletrial.com/code. That's audibletrial.com/code. Yeah, well, we brought you on to talk about AREL or Errol. I've heard it.
I think it's AREL.
I think it's AREL is the way that I've heard it from the Rails people. But yeah, it's always interesting to hear a little bit of that background. School district and then, yeah, nonprofits. Yeah. That's interesting.
All over the place.
Yeah. So, but let's dive in here. So why AREL? I mean, people mostly just use the Rails Active Record stuff, right?
Right.
And I think it wraps over the top of it.
Yeah.
So why do we care? It's just it's a little layer that I don't have to think about, right?
Right. Most of the time you're working in Active Record, and I remember the first time I saw Active Record and I was like, man, this is awesome. Because I was coming from PHP and all that kind of stuff. So this isn't about how Active Record is broken or wrong or something, but definitely instances where you need to drop down and work directly with the database. And my app is a reporting app. And so we use a lot of database specific features, aggregations. We do a lot of calculations and processing in the database. And if you're going to do that, at least today, you have to drop down to SQL. There are some things where Active Record over the years has added these fancier features, but for the most part, you have to drop down to SQL if you're going to really make use of some of these more powerful features.
Now, I guess before we get started, I want to ask a question around this, because writing SQL on a day-to-day basis within my Rails application does not sound like fun. It sounds very messy.
Right.
Specifically messy coming back to either refactor or to modify that line of SQL. Yeah, you know, it kind of reminds me of like Perl. It's, yeah, you can at one point like write it and then maybe in the future read it, but it's not exactly something that you want to do, at least in my opinion. So would a alternative to using AREL be using a database view table where you
yes.
have all the calculations that's happening on the database side and you can then just interact with it like a regular Active Record object?
Yes, absolutely. So there's actually a cool gem called Scenic, and it helps you manage these database views and materialized views, where basically you have a SQL file and it says, hey, database, pretend this query is like a permanent table. And, you know, there's various ways to update that data. But then when as far as the database is concerned, it's just a table, then you can totally just, as far as Active Record knows, it's just like any of the other tables, and then you can have that nice, clean Active Record interface. And I would say oftentimes, no matter what you do, in order to get to where you have that maintainability, the way I like to talk to our devs about it is we're always trying to push back to vanilla Rails, right? Even if we're doing something fancy, let's try to make our objects look like Active Record objects when it's appropriate, or, you know, try to use the same controller view patterns and all that kind of stuff. Don't step too far out of that. But yeah, to your question, if you're dealing with a lot of SQL and you have strings and stuff, here's how I would say it. The Active Record is like the starting point. Then, okay, I've got something fancier. That's where you decide, would something like a materialized view work for me? For our application is like a report. You can think of it as a reporting app. It's like a reporting app as a service almost kind of thing. And so our users can change the filters and settings you know, imagine a very complex search thing where they can just change stuff on the fly. And that's where materialized view stops being so beneficial, because materialized view is kind of like a denormalization, right? It's like you have your tables, they're all separate, you know, posts and comments, and then you kind of want to put them together into like, here's a closer representation of what I'm going to show to my end user. And I'm going to kind of put that data together so it's fast. But we have a whole lot of data, and we have a multi-tenant kind of situation where we have different customer, different accounts, and then they can all change these settings and stuff. So just for our application, the kind of the raw data that we get from the customer is kind of, there are opportunities for us to do these kind of cache tables or something like a materialized view, but there's not a lot of places where that makes sense for us. And so we build that on the fly often with complex SQL, because we don't know ahead of time, often we don't know ahead of time what the user is looking for. And so then we try to cache it closer to the end user, if that makes sense, instead of in the database. But the materialized view thing is totally cool. And if you could do it, that's actually probably better than what we do, but doesn't work out so well for us.
I want to press pause here real quick, because we've used a couple of terms.
Yes.
Assumed that people know what they are.
I don't know what materialized view means. Help.
Yeah, yes. Materialized view. I don't think we really even mentioned what ARL is.
Yeah.
You know, I think people, to some degree, if they're working in Rails and they've had to mess with the database at all, they at least have an idea of what SQL is.
Yeah.
Even if they haven't had to, you know, write SQL or bash their head against the wall or anything else equally painful.
Yeah.
So can we just define some of these terms? SQL, yeah. ARL, yeah, and materialized views.
Absolutely. Yeah. So SQL is the language you talk to typical relational database today. And that's just it's a language that says, here's the data, here's how I want the data to look as it comes back out. It's like that's a whole show in itself of what SQL could be. But that's how you talk to the database and say, put my tables and do this with the data and give me this result. And so take that in your mind. And so then a view is like, okay, database, I want to store this special SQL that I've kind of put together and pretend the results are just like any other table. And so what the database does with that is your application might hit this like fake table. It's like a pseudo table almost. And behind the scenes, the database, okay, I'm going to run this query against the real tables and put it together and present it as if it was any other table in the database.
For me, the way that I think about it is essentially people are pretty familiar with the idea of indices in SQL tables, right? So every time you add something to the table, it updates the index. And so it keeps a running list, essentially. It's a B tree, but we don't need to go into that.
Yeah.
it keeps a running list of how to quickly order whatever it is that you have out of the table, right? And so every time you add something in, it updates the index. Well, it's the same thing, except it's essentially keeping separate copy of the results of whatever query you would make.
Right. That's specifically what a materialized view is.
Yes.
Where it's actually storing that somewhere. Yep. And then
it makes it really fast. And so if you're doing reporting and things like that, which is what we were talking about, it makes that real fast, because it doesn't have to go grind through the data and say, okay, sort it by this and then partition it by this and then do this other thing with it and then twist it around this way and then squeeze it out through this round tube.
Exactly. Yeah. So where we're like, maybe the materialized view doesn't work for us, is that we would have to update that so often that it might as well just be doing it on the fly as needed.
Yeah, your reports are custom queries, and so you can't just save it that way.
Yeah, but if your app does, you should absolutely go to that first before you're going to maybe build the complex stuff that we might talk about later. So yeah, I think we defined all of those.
And ARL.
ARL is what Active Record uses under the hood to build SQL code, right? So ARL takes your post.find1 and turns that into select star from posts where ID equals one, right? So it's at a basic high level, it's kind of like a translator, but we could get into more of kind of how it actually works, which is interesting to me at least. It was one of those things, when I first heard about ARL, I was like, man, that's deep computer science-y kind of stuff, you know? I wonder if I'll ever understand that, you know? And then after I got a couple of kind of key concepts, it's like, oh, okay, this makes total sense. The other thing I should say real quick is that ARL also, it's the like compatibility layer where you could write the same active record for a dozen different databases. And ARL will kind of figure out, okay, what's the like Postgres specific lingo here? What's the MySQL specific lingo here? You know, what about Microsoft SQL Server? There's a whole list of different databases that Rails supports. And it can do that in the same way because of the ARL library.
right? It's the jQuery for databases.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, it's like, let's build an abstraction layer over all the weirdnesses that the browsers, you know, would do and make make JavaScript nice, and at least until everyone comes together and and agrees on how it should be.
Yeah, standardizes.
Yeah.
I'm not holding my breath for databases.
Yeah, that's right.
It's probably worth saying that the materialized views don't auto-update. So one of the reasons they're fast is it runs the query once, and then it does it sit on the disk? Presumably it must sit on the disk somewhere.
I think it's stored just like any other database, and it's kind of up to you to keep it up to date. That's why it didn't make a ton of sense for us, because we'd be constantly thrashing that table, so to speak.
I was going to say, then you're maintaining all of those triggers and so many other things, which is its own thing.
Yep.
Awesome. All right. So we got this all defined. So Dave asked, why, Eric? Why?
Why not strings is probably a good thing to focus on. Like, why not just use strings? So you're like, okay, I can't just use Active Record. I need to write raw SQL. Why not just use strings and do it the PHP style, which I think someone said. And that's totally valid. And the way I would say it is, if you have one or two cases where it's like, I got to drop down to SQL and I've got this very optimized thing that I'm running, then a string probably makes a ton of sense. But where strings become less of a good thing is when you have a lot of them and you have to worry about maintainability. And then when you're building SQL, especially if you're like going to combine different things, you got to keep track of when you write a SQL query, it's asking for columns and table names, and you got to keep all those straight. If you have a big blob of text in a string, and maybe you're doing some, you have some variables in there to make it do what you want, and you got to keep a bunch of stuff straight that ARL could do for you. And probably the main selling point for dropping down to, for using ARL instead of just strings, is the composability, where you can just you can have separate classes that kind of get combined into one structure in ARL without going into the details. And then ARL will figure out, okay, he's asking for these columns from this part and these columns from this other part, and I'm gonna keep it all straight, and then the output is correct. That might not have made too much sense over pure audio, but...
Does SQL seem like an angry language to you?
Yes. Maybe not angry, but dense. It's like...
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's a very... you're used to doing all this lovely JavaScript, friendly Ruby, right, and even C#, you know, it's not so bad. And then you get the kind of really stern languages like Objective-C, where everything's capitalized and it feels a bit formal. And then SQL comes in, and it's kind of like, select all, star.
It's very loud because it's often capitalized. Yeah, it's like shouting.
You guys do know that you don't have to capitalize it, right?
Yeah.
John is such a rebel.
Actually, I like the capitalized stuff. I think it looks prettier, but so that's what I do.
I do.
John is such a conformist.
Yeah. I do it most of the time so I can keep different terms straight. But yeah, it is. It's like with a language like Ruby or JavaScript, you're saying, here's what I want to do. Like, I'm starting with some data and here's what I want to do. I'm going to go through some like loops and, you know, have some control, some if else kind of stuff. And then I kind of imagine what will come out the other end of my code. Whereas SQL is all about the part that comes out the other end. It's like, here's what I want it to look like, database, and you go figure it out how to make it happen. And so it's a different way of thinking for sure.
I think that's an important point to reiterate, because I was going to make it if no one ever got to that. It's like in SQL, you're not telling the database what to do. You are describing to the database the data set and how you want it arranged.
Right.
And the database then says, how do I grab this data? Let me figure this out. And it does all that for you.
Right. Which is a complete paradigm shift, probably for most people.
I thought I was the boss.
One thing I should say, like, what unlocked it for me was this concept called a CTE, or I'm blanking on what that means, common table expression. And that's one of the reasons why we dropped down to ARL, to use ARL, is because then we can work with this thing called a CTE. But you can think of a CTE as a more object-oriented way of thinking about SQL, or at least that's how I think about it, where you can say, okay, I'm just going to start with step one like one transformation, and then I'm going to add another one and another one. And at the end, I'll just have like a really simple select from this thing I've kind of built up from top to bottom. Whereas otherwise, a lot of complex SQL has like these nested statements, and it's not very easy to read or reason about. But if people are interested in kind of getting deeper into SQL, I recommend looking into this idea called a CTE or common table expression, because that kind of unlocked it for me. It's like, okay, now I can like think step by step how I'm transforming stuff, and then kind of get the output at the end. It gets it a little closer to regular languages, if you will.
They're super powerful. And yeah. You suddenly found yourself reaching for CTEs, yeah. And now you couldn't write that because it is a thing that Active Record doesn't natively support.
Right.
You now we're like, now I need to write this in Arrow, yeah. April, whatever it is.
Exactly, yeah. And that also helps us. So we do a lot of taking, how do I explain this? So we have the kind of reports that we're showing that are like, let's just say there's a handful of common transformations that might come from, or that might be shared across multiple reports, right? So we have a place there where we can reuse some code, right? And so our query objects, as we call them, that wrap some ARel are small discrete pieces that we can mix and match for the final report that we're trying to build, the final query we're trying to build. And so that's where ARel again comes in, because we can say, all right, take this piece or this little snippet of ARel or SQL concept, if you will, and kind of put them all together for the final thing. And ARel handles that building behind the scenes, that putting together the SQL concepts, so to speak, and then kind of puts it all together into the SQL that we need, right?
So I'm still a little bit disconnected from, okay, when would I use ARel? When would I use Active Record?
Right. You would use Active Record as much as possible. So if you're doing the kind of standard blog stuff, like posts.all, you know, post.where, whatever.
Right.
You're definitely going to stick with Active Record. But we are doing things like, so I was just talking about this like CTE idea where we're kind of step by step. We might start with, our app is all about donations. So we'll say, okay, find all the first time donors in this date range. That's mm-hmm. like one CTE. And then the next step would be, okay, take those people and count them, turn them into counts. So I'm trying to avoid getting too much into like the actual SQL statements.
Right.
But one of the things you can do with a database that's usually referred to as an aggregation, you can say, so imagine you have donations that all fall on a date. They're all entered on a certain date. You can say, okay, take the month part of that and then sum the amount part.
Right. Okay.
And then group by the month, right? So then you have the sum of all donations for each month, right? But if you want, that's kind of a simple thing. But so we'll take like, okay, get all the people who gave for the first time in this month or in this time range, and then sum up all their donations by week, so say over this time range. So you're building something that might end up as a chart, right? You have the points on a graph that are the sum or the total count for a date. These are the kinds of things we're doing behind the scenes with SQL that you could build with Ruby, really. You could just stick with Active Record, just pull out all the raw data and I'll iterate over it with Ruby, right? But we have what I like to say medium data. Like we don't have a massive database, but we have millions and millions of rows, about 500 gigabytes to a terabyte of data. And so we're not gonna pull that all over the network and then load it into memory and then, you know, build these counts and sums and stuff. We wanna do all of that in the database. And that's where Active Record has some simple concepts like sum and that kind of stuff, but we can't do these step-by-step transformation type SQL just with Active Record, if that makes sense.
I actually have another example too.
Yeah.
So I've actually done this before too, which is why I'm like super interested in this topic myself. But I've worked on two different ERP systems over the course of my career. And one of them I still work on, just keep the lights on for them and things. And in this particular one, we did something like this or whatever, because there are, so I thought it was interesting that you brought up like a filtering system. Like I felt over the course of my career, this is like the most common place that you'll get it, where you mm-hmm. create a complex filtering system and you start to get to this point where Ransack no longer works for you.
Yeah.
Ransack's great, I feel mm-hmm. like in the medium or whatever, but yep. you get to a point where you're just like, well, if I put something in this one field right here, now I have to join another table, except that it's not just a regular join. Like maybe I have to do some aggregation on that table before mm-hmm. I can join it, depending on what you put in the field. Or if I combine these two fields over here, now I have aggregations matched with aggregations. And then all of a sudden, this is where CTs are like really awesome. You're just like, mm-hmm. okay, whenever I add this field in, I need this special CTE that like gets everything ready to combine with everything else, right?
Exactly.
And I only need to include that when I have this one field in my filter. And then you can combine multiple CTEs together. Like that's when I feel like you get into like this complex, like yep. just figuring out how to do this stuff. And if you were to write one of these queries, you don't have to use CTEs. It's absolutely possible to write yep. any one of these queries without CTEs. It's possible to write these queries using window functions and things like that. But trying to dynamically do it is where it gets mm-hmm. really yep. complicated and hard. And then CTEs are like fantastically awesome. Yeah, that's what I would say is like when you're doing something like that, where you're just like, where you're really like filtering something where the user gets to define, gets to build mm-hmm. up the query themselves, right? And you're kind of just trying to support that dynamic aspect of it. That's yes. when I found that I needed to dig.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I'm trying to say. Like we have a custom search situation where people can add multiple filters, you know, with like a nested form kind of thing. And those filters just all end up as a CTE later. And then kind of the final bit of SQL is, okay, join these things together and give me the result. And it's all dynamic. And, you know, you're able to inject like Ruby conditional code in there as needed and all that kind of stuff. You can use Ruby is kind of where it comes down to why you would use A Rails, because I want to use Ruby to conditionally and based on logic put this final SQL string together.
Yeah, your logic ends up being Ruby.
So how exactly do you use A Rails then? I mean, is it basically a DSL over the top of SQL or
kinda. It's not too different from Active Record. It's definitely different where you have to kind of learn a few things, but it's not drastically different. You can start, if you're like playing in a console or something, you can pull up one of your Active Record models, like for instance, post, and do post.arel_table. And then you're like in AREL land where, okay, now I have the beginnings of the AREL node structure where I can start tacking on stuff. And from there, you could say like, there is a learning curve because you're like, some of the terms are different. You can't just say .select because that's for some reason, not the word. You have to do .project. And then you can put in the columns you want and so on and so forth. So some of this is hard to kind of talk through without
yeah.
visuals, but
I found that when you're using this stuff, there's a lot of guessing the magic word
yep.
with Arrow. I wanted to do what's called a modulo lookup in Postgres, yep. which is dead easy to do in raw SQL. But you try and find that in Arrow, you know,
yeah.
and it's not just that, like you said, even select is not select, it's project.
Yep.
Is there a big list of magic words? What do you use?
I learned how to read the source, to be honest.
that's the worst answer.
Yeah.
I think your IQ just went up about 80 points in my head.
Well,
API docs.
There are API docs, yeah. So this is where we should talk about maybe should you use SQL or should you use AREL? I guess probably the common theme in this. The documentation isn't really there because AREL is considered private API, but there is, if you Google, there's articles, there is like the Ruby doc output, you know, that you can find and kind of get some ideas there. But I eventually just figured out how to read the source so I could really figure out what's going on. But how about this? I'll give you some tips. Sometimes
I don't want to read the source.
Yeah,
that's the fairest. The only thing worse than reading the source is writing it yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, Luke. I mean, honestly, it's just Ruby. It's like reading yeah. English, right?
Oh my word!
Once you get a couple of the ways that AREL works, it's actually pretty easy to read. But AREL's really trying to stick strings together.
That does not make me feel better.
Oh, that hurts so much. Okay, so I actually disagree. Okay, so let's hash this out because maybe my understanding is wrong. So my way of understanding what AREL is it's basically building an abstract syntax tree.
Yep, which another thing we should define.
Yep, exactly, right. So I'll try and go there in just a second. If you're not familiar with that, and that doesn't just like straight up ring you, we're building this gigantic graph mm-hmm. of your query, which is, I think, so, I mean, that's basically what an abstract syntax tree is, right? Like it's basically, hey, I have, you know, this piece, and then, you know, hey, maybe it has a left and a right hand thing. And then I do something to go left hand, right hand, right? Well, in this case, it's like, for example, when you say, I think the easiest thing is if you're adding conditions to your where clauses, right? So if I want to say, hey, I want to find something between two dates, right? Like between has a left-hand date and a right-hand date. And so, you know, your abstract syntax tree in Arrow is going to be a between node, right? With its left-hand being, you know, the date that's on the left-hand side and the date that's on the right-hand side, right? And so we build this tree to build this query, right? Like the string query. And it sounds like super crazy. And the thing that I was going to try and get to is I think the issue with Arrow is it's very hard to conceive of, for most people in my experience, for most people, to conceive of your query, which is just a string to almost everybody. And I think SQL is hard for a lot of people in the first place.
Right.
But then to abstract at another level and say, hey, I'm going to build this gigantic tree just so that I can get my computer to dynamically build this for me. Like you have multiple levels of abstractions that are hard.
Yep.
And I think that's the main challenge actually with Arrow at its core.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. That's like a hard thing to keep in your head. And if you like, if you're in a console and you like output the data structure of an Arrow thing, it's like pages and pages of these little nodes, little node objects. And I kind of try to skip that and ignore it. And then I look at like the individual node classes and think, so what started us down this trail was your question about like, how do I figure out what to do? And oftentimes you can use this Arrow node called a named function. So you can say like, if the SQL you want is a word with parentheses and like an argument or a list of arguments to that, then I just reach for this thing called named function and it builds that thing, right? So I'm going to say, here's the name of the thing. Here's the arguments to it. Just kind of figure it out. It works out, right? Like almost 8 times out of 10, I would say that's the SQL I want. And then there's some other like nodes that I've used to like hack together when it's something really weird that I want to do. But yeah, it's definitely a complex thing, but you kind of muddle through it.
Yeah, one tip I'm going to throw out on this is one website that I really love for getting an idea of what an abstract syntax tree looks like is asdexplorer.net. And it defaults to JavaScript, but you can choose other languages, and one of them is SQL.
Okay.
And so then you can kind of look at it. And the way that I would recommend that you look at it is essentially you go in and, you know, switch it over to SQL, and then it will break it down into the AST. Mm-hmm. And what I want you to do, and you can switch it over, it has a tree view and a JSON view. So look at the JSON view. And then from there, just kind of look at it from the standpoint of, if I had to parse a messy string versus parsing this really nice object that breaks it down into a standard way, I'd much rather write a program that did the right thing off of this really nice object that I've got sitting here.
Right. I think another way to think of it is to define abstract syntax tree backwards. It's like first of all, it's a tree. It's a data structure. It's a pile of data. And then it's syntax. It's like, okay, the language for the computer or some kind of compiler, right? And then it's abstract in that it separates the idea that you're trying to accomplish, the thing you're trying to accomplish, from the implementation of that idea. And that's what Arrow does. Is it builds up this abstract syntax tree. And at that point, like you were saying, Charles, it's like, okay, now we can write a program to translate those ideas into whatever we need. And so then under the hood, Arrow takes that abstract syntax tree and uses another fancy computer science term, the visitor pattern, which is basically just a visitor is like an object that is going to look at this tree and do the specific thing for its specific purpose, right? So Arrow has a Postgres visitor, it has a MySQL visitor, there's a Microsoft SQL Server visitors, IBM database, you know, every different database has its own visitor. So that visitor knows, okay, I see this node. For example, if you say, I want to limit my results to 5 rows, if I limit 5, in MySQL and Postgres, that SQL is limit 5. But in other databases, it might be like take 5 or top 5, or, you know, there might be there's different SQL there, right? So the visitor goes, okay, for me, I'm going to take that limit node, or that, I forget exactly what it is under the hood, but that limit idea, and I'm going to translate it into the database specific SQL for what I'm doing. So between those, if you can get through those two concepts, then I think, okay, I kind of get what Arrow is doing in the source. It's okay, this half of the code is about turning the nodes into actual SQL strings, and the other half is about building that node structure, that big tree.
So I have one question slash criticism about Arel.
Okay.
Is that if they've gone through all the effort of building these tie-ins to the various databases and it's available in Arel, why isn't it available in Active Record?
I think it's a, so I don't know. We would have to ask the Rails course team, but my speculation is that that is, it's harder to move some of these concepts up into the layer of abstraction that that Active Record lives in, right? It's that really nice ergonomic world. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom is the unergonomic world of SQL, right? And in between is kind of with Arel. And it's like, it seems to me like over the years that the core team has done their best to get that Arel layer nice. But they have, until recently, I would say, they've said, you know, we're not taking bug requests for Arel because it is what it is. They consider it private API. So like if Rails changed how has-many worked, right? You better believe there would be blog posts and deprecation warnings and all this kind of cycle to get everybody ready. You know, hey, this thing that everybody uses is going to change soon. But between versions, Arel, there's no warning, right? Between major Rails versions. So, and that's what they mean when they say it's like private API. I've talked to a couple of the Rails core team people about it. It's like, is it wrong to use Arel? Do you not want people to use Arel, or do you, and they're kind of like, well, you know, it's there and absolutely use it, but use it with the understanding that you're responsible for it in a bigger sense than you would be for your Active Record code. It's not that it's not tested or it's going to, you know, break, but it's more your responsibility to make sure, like between versions, that what you're expecting out of it is what you're expecting out of it, right? So we test every bit of Arel code that we write. And a couple times when we move between versions, there's like white space changes, right? I'm like, okay, that's pretty easy to figure out. Or, you know, we always catch it because we're always testing all the Arel code, but we have to adapt to move Arel. We have a lot of Arel in our app. That probably wouldn't be the same for everybody, but as we've moved upgraded Rails, we've had to make a few little changes.
Hey folks, this is Charles Maxwood, and I just launched my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. It's up on Amazon. We self-published it. I would love your support. If you want to go check it out, you can find it there. The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. Have a good one. Max out.
It is pretty stable. Yeah. I might add, like, I don't think that Eric's warning should seem
scary. Yeah, it shouldn't be too scary. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty stable. For the most part, my experience over the years with it has just been that they just keep adding features, mm-hmm. not that they break stuff.
Right. Yeah. So it's not that it's prone to break. It's just that things change in little ways. And so you want to test it. But if you have reasonable test coverage on it, I think you can be confident in using Arel. But recently they said, at least on the Ruby on Rails Discord forum, that they're looking to make it more of a, for lack of a better word, public thing where people use it more and more. And they're trying to improve the ergonomics in on Arel and that kind of stuff. It's just a... you know, if you've written a gem or anything like that, you've got a lot of implementation details that you're like, I wish this was a little nicer, but for the time being, it works, right?
So there are some interesting things, partly to answer your question, Dave. Like I've been trying really hard since we started this to come up with something. Window clauses, I think, are a really mm-hmm. good example of something that doesn't really fit. Like it would be really hard to do that using Rails's Active Record syntaxes. I mean, I suppose there's possibly a way to do it, but I can't think of one off the top of my head, right? But like, that's an awkward one to do no matter what. And I think features like that that you have in SQL that Arel has implemented, I think might be hard to like bring up.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that, but.
One of the things that's changed recently, like Rails 6, you used to have, if you were going to do an upsert, it was very database specific. I should define upsert. So you can tell some databases, hey, I want to insert this record, but if it's already there based on ID or some other information, then just update a couple of the columns in it, right? So it's like a insert, but if it's already there, update, right? And normally with Active Record, you might just do like an if statement, but then you have a couple of database hits. Right. And if you're doing thousands of records, then it doesn't make sense. So if you're going to build like an upsert kind of style thing, you would have to write SQL. But in Rails 6, they kind of made that possible. And now there's an insert all, and I think there's some other ways of doing an upsert style mass inserts with the actual Active Record API. So some of this stuff is bubbling up to the top for sure, as it makes sense. I think, John, the way you said it is right, that some stuff they're holding back because the like API isn't there yet. It's like not obvious. But I made a minor contribution to Rails recently where I made the ergonomics of making a CTE in A-Rail just a little nicer, more consistent. So there is some effort there, especially as people like me are interested in making that a little better, but it's not probably as, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not as well known as all the other features of Rails, and so it doesn't get as much attention.
So I kind of want to follow up with some of this stuff because it should be pretty clear at this point. Arrow is a fairly complex thing. It's a heavily abstracted thing. I mean, it is not the first thing that I reach for in any app, right? It's definitely one of the last things. It's a very powerful tool, but it really only makes sense as soon as I've basically exhausted everything else. Active record queries are not doing it for me. You know, my materialized views are either, you know, becoming burdensome, or they're just not, I just can't get what I want or something. Then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, now I can reach for this Arrow tool. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's been your experience with so you're the CTO of this small company. So I assume that you have some other people that are working with you. Yep. Do you find that everyone off the street understands this? Do you find that you're having to heavily train them? I mean, in your video, you basically showed us some of your abstractions. Really cool, by the way. I mean, do you do these abstractions because they're necessary in order to help people understand this stuff? Or, you know, yeah, I guess hopefully you see where I'm going. I'm asking a bunch of questions here.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that is a consideration for sure, is that, like, how do I disseminate this on my team? And we have a small team, so I can afford to meet one-on-one, or we can, you know, talk through it. And I do basically what I did in my video, which is we've got a nice GUI SQL editor, a database app on one side, and then like A-Rail code on the other. And we start with the SQL. It's like, okay, here's kind of what the SQL is doing. And we can look step by step, CTE by CTE, really, and say, here's the output of each of these things. And so we kind of need to, with the team, you kind of have to understand like the purpose of this thing first. But then we have some, like, our query objects have mostly the same interfaces, if that makes sense. Right. So there's between query objects, there's not a whole lot of new stuff to learn. If you get the basics of A-Rail, you can, in our app, you can look, okay, what the query method is, where most of the A-Rail lives. And then we, you know, in good Ruby practice, we try to factor out stuff that we're using a lot of, you know, like I said, with this like named function thing, like maybe you want to do a distinct count like Postgres has this nifty feature where you can select some and filter that thing, and then select some and filter that kind of clause a little differently, right? And you would have to go through a lot more SQL to try to figure that out. And you could basically put a where clause in there. So you could, like, say count posts where status is published. And then on the next line you do, or you know, count posts where status is not published, basically. And then you can get those counts out, right? So you can do kind of a where clause on the select line if you're familiar enough with the SQL. But for those kinds of things, we just make a Ruby method that takes arguments, right? And we put all those in some mix-ins, right? And so then our query object includes kind of our common A-Rail functions, so to speak. And they have nice names, right? So then the team goes, okay, I know what this is doing, even if I don't necessarily know exactly how, you know, in various instances, how Eric figured out how to hack A-Rail to get it to do what we want, right? So we've made it possible to learn it in phases, I guess, is the answer in our team.
Yeah, there's training involved / guardrails, I guess, right?
For yes.
People that don't quite understand it yet.
Right.
Isn't Postgres a lot better than MySQL? Absolutely. Let's just take a minute to being on the Rails journey. It was all MySQL back in 2010. Look how the MySQL has fallen.
There's not even a controversy about that. That's a settled thing.
I was at an event, a DevOps event in 2015 in San Bruno somewhere. And this guy was just raving about Postgres and how it was a proper database. And I thought, it can't be true because everyone's using MySQL.
Right.
Now, 6 years later, Yeah. I would. You can take my Postgres from my cold, dead hand.
Yes. That's how I feel too. I started on MySQL though too, just because that's what all Rails developers did. But then I dabbled in MongoDB for a while and then...
No.
Yeah.
No.
And then I found out that that's not a good idea from the internet told me. But then along that time, Postgres added all its JSON functions. So I was like, okay, I can get all the reliability of a relational database and I can do the nifty JSON stuff that I've been dabbling with. And then I went to Postgres and never looked back.
I remember when Postgres just had HStor and we had some dude in the office who really wanted to go to Mongo and he was trying really hard to convince us. And he sent us all this article comparing Postgres's HStor performance to MongoDB. Uh-huh. And I like read this article and I was like, dude, did you read this article? I was like, every single thing in here says that HStor performs better than MongoDB at everything, except for like one thing in the whole thing. Where it was like tied. I was like, you're not helping yourself.
Right.
Whatever. But yeah, that was before it got JSON. Yeah. That was before it got JSON or whatever native and it was already better. It was
I don't know, guys. SQLite. Everything else is bloatware.
Yeah.
SQLite is quick.
Yeah. If you have a really tiny database, I agree.
I've got a 1.6 gigabyte SQLite database. And above that, it struggles. But, 1.6 gig on the disk, that's a pretty happy database.
Very cool.
Okay, I'm desperate to talk about speed because there are some people who are very skeptical as to the value of abandoning Active Records, lovely abstractions for diving into the kind of dangerous, but attractively dangerous waters of the Arrow API. This the fundamental motivator behind all of this is speed, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I think you're right, because otherwise you could just write Ruby and not even, think about it. Just pull all the raw data from the database and work it all out in your app. And
so can you quantify how much faster this approach is, like the big win from doing it this way? Can you put a number on it?
Not exactly. And we should always caveat any performance discussions with, you have to measure first, right?
But anecdotes are the best science.
Yes. Right. So definitely feels faster. But I would say, so you get to a point like we're at, where if you're going to do some calculation over millions and millions of rows, you might get to a point where your Ruby never finishes because you have filled up your memory and you're just kind of looping through something. Well, first of all, probably the biggest thing is like, okay, we got to wait for all this data to come over the network. If you have like a separate app server from your database server, and then we're going to create active record objects for each of these things, fill up memory, and then you're like looping through this stuff and you just like from technically might not be able to accomplish something massive in a reasonable amount of time at all. So you have to then move to, all right, I need to minimize what's coming over the wire into my application. I need to do all of these calculations in Postgres. So another thing we do with SQL is our import process. So we import from all our customers every night, and we're importing maybe 300 gigabytes or more over that time. And we are doing most of that ETL, that extract transformation load, in Postgres. So we have like figured out how to, like our background jobs are using the raw Postgres connector. And they're using the Postgres copy command, which is like...
It's a great command. That stuffs the data in faster than anything else.
Yes. Look that up if you're doing any kind of importing into a database. It's pretty awesome. So it's like, okay, as fast as possible, just fire hose this data into the database. So that's what we do. We like, okay, how fast can we don't want to DDoS our customers with API requests. So it's like, okay, how fast can we just hit their database, their thing, and then stop, right? So we just pull in all the data into our database, and then we do all the transformations and movement into the actual working tables, if you will, all in SQL. And if we tried to do that in Ruby, which we did actually a couple of years ago, we used to do a lot of that work in Ruby and Active Record. And we got to the point with the number of customers we have that sometimes we wouldn't finish our imports in a 24-hour window, right? So we're trying to keep all of our customers' data up to date, within 24 hours every day. But, eventually we got to the point where it's like, okay, we're constantly importing and it slows down the app and all that kind of stuff. And it's no good, right? So we got to speed this up. So we moved as much as we could to the database layer. And at least today, our imports finished before morning Eastern, you know, where our customers are waking up over here on the East Coast.
And so you're going from kind of 24 hours down to 3?
Well, maybe not 3, but like 6. Right, where we can start importing. We'll start in the early evening Eastern Standard Time and then finish. Yeah, maybe. I haven't actually looked into that, but yeah, that's kind of the, to give you some numbers, it's like it's an order of magnitude probably where we're doing most of the stuff in the database. Now, that goes against sometimes my preference. Like my preference is, let's keep this thing vanilla Rails as most as possible so that when we bring new people on, it's like, here's a Rails app. You know, you already know how to deal with it. But for performance, sometimes we've had to step outside that and try and, you know, lean on the database as much as possible.
I think if you imagine Errol is just creating raw SQL queries, then whatever anecdotal stories you have of converting, you know, some active record thing to a raw mm-hmm. SQL query, right? It would fit this, right? So
yeah.
That app that I was referring to earlier, when I first came on, they had this one report that took an hour and a half to run, you know, because it was just running in Ruby and they just accepted that,
yeah.
You know, and I came and, you know, somewhere in there, I was like, huh, this is really kind of dumb. So, you know, we added some indexes that didn't exist that, you know, I discovered because I ran whatever that one tool is that looks for indexes. And I was like, huh, we should probably have these foreign key references is in that way. So we added indexes, you know, I converted it to a SQL query using Errol, right? And that thing ran in 500 milliseconds. So yeah. Like, I feel like if you have a query that like gets up over like 15 minutes, I feel like it just balloons out really fast. So
yeah,
you can quickly turn that stuff really fast. But yeah, that's, I guess all I was trying to get at is like Errol is basically any story you have of converting an active record thing to a raw SQL query, like that's going to apply to Errol. Errol is just a way of writing raw SQL queries that I think is manageable when they, you know, get to like 500 lines long or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's
even 50 is rough.
Probably the bottom line. It's like, I want maintainable SQL. Probably might want to reach for Errol.
Nice. One thing that I'm wondering about a little bit as we kind of wrap up is, so let's say that I get to the point where, you know, some of the things you or John talked about here regarding, okay, I need to switch to Errol for performance or for, you know, some feature that is ugly in active record, but, you know, if you understand how your database engine works and how the SQL goes together, you can make it happen. How do I test that?
Yeah, we just test like bits of strings. So if there's like a thing where it's like, okay, I'm doing something that even like it's kind of hacky, like I said, with this filter idea or that modular thing you were trying to do, you know, if you're like, okay, I'm getting Arel to kind of put some stuff together that is maybe off the beaten path, then we're just like testing that the output looks, you know, do these strings equal? Really, it's what I do is I say we have an RSpec, you know, spec. And the subject is the SQL output of one of our query objects. And then I just say test that the output includes, expect that the output includes this bit of SQL that I expected to get outputted. And I don't test like every bit of it because you can trust that Arel is doing, you know, what it's built to do because Arel's tested itself. But I test like the fancier stuff that I'm doing just to make sure. And then the other thing I do is I execute that SQL against the database. Even if there's no data for it to work on, I send the query string to Postgres. And then if it's an invalid Postgres syntax, right? If it's invalid SQL, Postgres will raise an error. So that's like a really easy test. It's just execute this SQL. I don't necessarily care about the results. Like for our app to build up all the like the expected data results, we haven't gotten there yet. We have some ideas of how to build up, you know, kind of a world of data. But what we do with these query objects is just test. Okay, the output is mostly doing what I'm expected to do. And Postgres likes it, right? Postgres doesn't say this is invalid, you know. So between those two things, it's kept us where we have confidence that these things are working.
I think it's, so I have a question and a comment, I think. So mm-hmm. I think it kind of fits in between, it's a concept sort of similar to unit testing. It has elements of unit testing and integration testing, right? Mm-hmm. The way that you, I feel like you kind of have to test this stuff because I've done it the same way too. So my question that follows up here is in your video, you know, from RailsConf or whatever you showed. You had your nice query object, and then you had like a couple methods that would add some like complexities to, you know, a given piece of query. So what I've done in the past, and I'm kind of asking if it looks kind of like this, is like maybe I have a conditional thing, right, where I might add a join, or I might add this projection or a select, basically, right? And so then the way that I've tested that is kind of to be like, oh, if I call this method on my query object, does it add this particular string to my, you know, query or not, right? If I don't call it.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. So anything that's like conditional, we wrap in like a context block in RSpec, you know, and then we say when the user asks for this situation, then make sure it shows this. Or sometimes when the user doesn't ask for this thing, make sure it doesn't do it, because we want to be fast as possible, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So then I would conclude, I think that testing is like, I don't know, it's different, but it's a logical extension of all the testing stuff that you've done prior, you know, and other things.
Yeah. The testing isn't magic. I think the only like interesting part of that is the send it to Postgres and have it try to parse it as like a general sanity test. Like if Postgres says, wait a minute, this SQL is no good, then you know, okay, something's wrong.
That's a super good tip. I've never even thought of that actually. And I've been doing this for a long time.
So the query builder goes over it and says, I like this SQL, then the test passes, right? If it doesn't raise an error, right? That's basically what the test is. Expect not to raise error. You know, and all of our query objects have a query method that returns the AREL so that we can combine it with some other query object. And then it has a SQL method or a toSQL method that outputs the string, right? And then it has an execute method, which really just calls Rails has, you could do post.connection.execute if memory serves, and give it raw SQL, and it will execute that SQL. We do some stuff on top of that, but that's basically what it does. And so we do that to execute the SQL, even if it's an empty test database, right? And Postgres looks over that and at least says the syntax is good or bad.
I'm excited for when we get active ARIL or whatever it is.
Active
query objects, yeah.
I've actually thought about building something very, like we were talking about, the ARIL source is not necessarily obvious to the regular user. I've thought about writing something that's very easier to get into that would build the kind of Postgres specific stuff that we need, like be it just a Postgres query builder that would be very, very classy, you know, and object oriented looking. All that kind of stuff, but maybe one day. A lot of people say there's a gem called SQL, spelled funny. Yep. You can put it in the show notes.
SQL.
A lot of people like that syntax. I haven't personally worked with
it. I thought that's how you did spell SQL for ages. I thought people were just like missing letters out.
Nice.
I think the like real purists say you're supposed to say SQL and not SQL. Could be wrong about that.
Cool. We're kind of getting toward the end of our time. Want to make sure we have time for picks. I guess the last two questions are there good resources for people to go look at, Eric? And where do people find you online if they want to follow up?
Yeah, that might be the same answer. You just hit me up on Twitter if you have a real question, because right now, so you can Google it and there are some resources out there. Some of them are, like John, you said, it hasn't changed that much, but every once in a while there's an old article that there might be a slightly nicer way of doing something. So there, people have written articles about it. There really isn't like a single source of here's where you go learn ARIL, unfortunately, today. But I'm happy to answer questions that I can. And you can hit me on Twitter. I'm ehayes, E-H-A-Y-E-S. I'm not super active on Twitter, but at me. And I'd love to help in any way I can.
Awesome. Are you freelancing or moonlighting? Or maybe you've thought about going out on your own? Every week, we have a group of developers at various stages of a freelancing journey on the Freelancer Show to talk about becoming better at freelancing. We also bring in experts to talk about marketing, SEO, and delivering high quality to clients. So if you're interested in going freelance or you are freelance, check it out at freelancershow.com.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and do some picks. Luke, do you want to start us off?
I've been sticking wires into my plug sockets at home, my mains plug sockets. This is not a good idea, children. Never stick metal things into your, what do you call it? Outlets uh-huh. In the States. You know, but kids, when you get older, then you'll find that you do need to do things like that. And I've been trying to track down sources of noise for my audio equipment, because mains hum just drives me absolutely insane. So if you want to safely have a look at all the strange harmonics and things in your house that are causing electrical noise, you can use a what's called a high voltage differential probe. And this is the safe, in inverted commas, way of doing it. And it's great. You know, you can kind of discover things about your electricity supply that you never even dreamed of. And you can find out that your fridge causes a kind of second octave B flat when it starts pumping out your cold stuff. So there we go. High voltage differential probes. What a pick for a software development episode.
Awesome. John, what are your picks?
Wow. I just have a little thing that like warns me when I'm like, you know, when I have an active voltage thing, so I can know to go turn off the breaker before I touch a thing. Okay, so my actual pick, also a not safe for kids pick, I guess technically. I don't know if you guys remember like buckyballs or whatever, those like little magnetic, I'm showing them to everybody. Oh, here, yeah. Those like magnetic balls or whatever that like you can make super awesome shapes with. You know, I had these in the bottom of my closet. Like, I mean, there's a lot of cool things from when I was younger that my four-year-old son is finding for me when I'm not prepared for him to do so. And, you know, so anyway, he's been playing with these a lot recently under supervision, of course. And he's also not a kid that likes to swallow things. So we're not as worried, you know, per se. But man, I forgot how awesome these were. And if you don't have some, like, legitimately need them, I'm just saying. It's kind of like things that you used to have before they invented fidget spinners, you know. Yeah. Anyway, so recommendation to go either find your old buckyballs or acquire some if you don't have them yet.
Wasn't there a sale ban on those a few years ago? Like years ago?
I thought something like that. And like they were going out of business. But then, I mean, I looked it up just now and they're apparently selling them again. So I don't know what's up, dude.
Maybe they won a court case or something.
Yeah, I don't know the answer.
Ruby Rogue's not liable for any of the information here in this podcast.
Any recommendations? Yeah.
I mean, acquire them somehow because they're cool.
And yeah, I found a Gizmodo article from 2012 about them being banned. So,
for
the curious mind, we'll put it in the show notes too.
I can buy it now, so I don't know how this works. If they're illegal, like I don't know.
Well, the problem is they're a choking hazard. So if a kid swallows them, just one little ball, it's not a big deal. They'll pass it. But if they then swallow another one a little bit later, then inside your intestines, they will connect. And that could rupture some inside stuff. And that's very, very dangerous.
There are.
God forbid people take responsibility for putting them where their kids can't reach them.
Yeah.
Oh. How many you have to swallow to be able to lift someone up?
Yeah, I mean,
hey Luke, next time we get together, I have this science experiment I want to try.
I've actually been the subject of medical experimentation, like just like Homer Simpson, for real. It's not a joke. I've done medical trials for cash.
What's your stomach capacity?
I didn't do all that right. Test.
I'm going to go ahead with my pick.
Yeah, do it, Dave.
So my first pick is the Elgato Stream Deck. I recently got one for my birthday, and it has been super cool. I've been using it for editing videos. So the Drift and Ruby videos that I do, I've created all the shortcuts on the Stream Deck to do the editing, and it's actually increased my productivity and workflow in doing that. So it's super cool. And one of the also cool things, and my second pick, is the Philips Hue lighting. So with this Stream Deck, it's basically a keypad that you can program to do a whole bunch of different macros and commands. And they have native support for the Philips Hue lighting system. So I can control the lights behind me and they just do really nice RGB coolness stuff.
Are you doing that with Ruby?
I am actually been hacking on a Ruby plugin that will allow you to extend the Stream Deck so much more and building a little mini framework around it. So not yet, but soon.
That's very cool.
Cool.
Nice. So I'm trying to get my head around what it is. So is it a hardware thing that sits on your desk?
Yes. The Elgato Stream Deck is basically a macro keyboard that you can program each one of the keys to do something different. So for example, I have one set up to notify me. This is one of the plugins I wrote. If Drift and Ruby goes down, then the little ping pong paddle turns red. If the SSL certificate's expiring within a year, then the little shield will turn red. Can also mute my Zoom microphone or unmute, set timers. I can control the lighting behind me. I can open up and execute any kind of macro or do keyboard shortcuts or do multi-actions.
This is in addition to your keyboard that you also have plugged in.
Correct.
Sweet. Yep. Nice. So. All right, cool. I'm going to throw in some picks. A couple things I'm working on, podcastplaybook.co and the most valuable developer, it's mostvaluable.dev is where I'm putting that. So you can go check those out. And kind of doing both of them in the same way where I'm going to have like a monthly virtual meetup where we answer questions and cover different things. And then, you know, I'm hoping to, you know, build out a course and do a mastermind group and things like that. So if you're interested in leveling up your career, especially if you're kind of at that mid level or low level senior that you feel kind of stuck, that's kind of where I'm really hoping to make a difference for folks. And yeah, just knock it out of the park for people with the most valuable.dev. So check those out. I finished the last Lightbringer book by Brent Weeks. If you're into fantasy novels, those were awesome. I really, really enjoyed those, and put a link to those in the show notes as well. And then, yeah, I've rearranged my office a bit because I'm going to start doing some video. And I have these really great lights. I don't have them on right now. So these guys looking at my video, half of my face is overexposed with light and the other half isn't. But I've got a light up here and it balances it out and it looks really nice. And
story so, Batman.
Yeah, there we go. Two-Face. I'm going to be going in, you know, so I'm going to be putting together the courses for both of these on running and managing a podcast and managing your software career. So anyway, I'll put a link to the lights in there as well. They're the newer with three E's, N-E-E-W-E-R light set, and they are awesome. They work great. Part of me thinks that they might have been recommended previously on the show by Dave. So I don't know. Might have been somebody else, but that's what I got. So
yep. No, that was me.
Okay.
I have some in my closet, which I am actually hopefully getting this Friday, the key lights from Elgato, mm-hmm. which can be controlled by the Stream Deck as well. So
that would be nice because I have to stand up and flip the switch on the back of these things.
A little hint for that. At Home Depot, uh-huh. they sell a remote control that gives you a two-plug prong that you can mm-hmm. plug both of the lights in, and then you get a keyless on-off switch, which will turn them on and off remotely.
That is a really great idea. Thanks, Dave.
Hey, that's all why right. you keep me around.
That's right. All right, Eric, what are your picks?
I got a couple picks. I've been playing this game called Good Sudoku instead of doom scrolling on social media. And it's pretty cool if you like Sudoku, like the puzzle aspect of it, but maybe don't want to do, you know, there could be a lot of busy work involved in Sudoku if you've ever played it. And this is like, it's like speed Sudoku almost if you set it up right. So yeah, that's the first thing I've been playing lately. And then my other pick would be this cool book that I just bought called Ansible for DevOps by this guy named Jeff Geerling. And if you've ever been exposed to the Ansible world, you've seen this guy's name and just prolific in the like number of Ansible playbooks that he's written. But this book I bought specifically because I want to figure out how to set up our deploy process so that it takes an app server out of the load balancer and does the update, puts it back in when it's ready to go. So you can do this kind of zero downtime deploy that way. Anyway, it's a good book full of lots of cool resources. If you manage your own infrastructure, if you want to use something like Ansible, it's a great little book.
Very cool. Well, thanks for coming, Eric. If you could just put links for those picks into the chat, that would be awesome. And then, yeah, thanks again, folks. If you have questions, twitter.com/ehayes. That's H-A-Y-E-S. And yeah, thanks again for coming. We'll wrap this up. And until next time, Max out.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.